And you've never touched a sewing machine. I can learn. I want to learn. Mrs. Crofton looked down at the drawings in her hand. It's no small feat to sew a gown that you have to make the pattern for. You'll have your work cut out for you, that's for sure, if you want to sew one of these. Is that what you were thinking?
I am. That is, if you think they're good enough.
I like this one. And this one. Mrs. Crofton held up two sketches. One of a billowy tea-length gown, with an empire waist and bell-shaped push-up sleeves. The other of a full-length draped confection, with an open back and sleeves of illusion.
Where did you learn to sketch, if I may ask? Do you have an art teacher at school? Or maybe one of your parents taught you?
A laugh crawled up Emmy's throat and she squashed it.
No. No art teacher.
And your parents? She cleared her throat so the laugh wouldn't escape.
My mother doesn't... She doesn't draw.
And your father, does he?
I wouldn't know.
An awkward silence followed. It was a wordless tension Emmy was familiar with, when someone asked her a question about her father and she had no answer. Since she had already fibbed about her age easily enough, what was another fabrication of the truth? And she wanted Mrs. Crofton to have no reason to regret hiring her.
He's dead.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that.
I don't even remember him. It happened a long time ago. I taught myself to sketch, Mrs. Crofton. I checked books out of the library, and I practiced on any blank piece of paper I could find. And then we moved here, and I saw the dresses in your shop, and I knew I wanted to design my own wedding gowns. This is what I want to do with my life.
Mrs. Crofton paused for a moment before continuing. I'm afraid I can't help you make any of the patterns you'll need. That's a different skill. You're going to need a dressmaker to help you with that. Emmy didn't know any dressmakers, and told the woman so. I know one, my cousin Graham. He might be persuaded to take you under his wing. He does that with young designers if he thinks they have potential. I can ask him if you're interested. It had been so long since someone other than Julia had taken an interest in anything important to Emmy that tears sprang to her eyes, stinging and sweet. Words failed her. Mrs. Crofton smiled, as if she knew Emmy was not used to favors.
Look, I know what it's like to have other people stand around, staring at you when they could just as easily help you, Emmeline. Who knows how long any of us will be around to think about bigger endeavors than just our own insignificant lives. Don't thank me yet. I can teach you to use my sewing machine, and I will contact my cousin to see if he is interested in taking you on as an apprentice. But in the end, only time will tell if a future in bridal gowns awaits you.
I don't know how to thank you. You can help someone else down the road, when the time comes. Emmy fingered away wetness at her eyes. She knew she would remember that moment for the rest of her life. That moment when somebody who barely knew her fulfilled every childhood wish she'd ever had to feel she mattered.
I'm so sorry about your window.
Emmy's voice sounded young in her ears. The swift change in the focus of the conversation seemed to surprise Mrs. Crofton.
Oh, well, glass can be replaced, will be replaced. It could have been worse. It can always be worse.
Emmy thanked her again, and Mrs. Crofton walked her to the door to let her out. The sky had turned purple and ash, and Emmy would be rushing to get back to the flat before the sun set completely. Mrs. Crofton's many kindnesses to her in the span it took for twilight to fall suddenly weighed on her like bricks.
I'm not nearly 16, Mrs. Crofton,
Emmy blurted as Mrs. Crofton lifted the latch.
I just turned 15 in April. I've 11 months until my next birthday, and I don't know who my father is. I don't even know if he's dead or alive.
The woman said nothing. For a second, Emmy was sure her late honesty had done her no favors. Then Mrs. Crofton swung the door open. Good thing I'm not hiring him, then. I'll see you on Tuesday, Emmeline. Emmy returned home floating on air.
barely aware that the inky shroud of London at night was enveloping her. She ran the last block in darkness. When she opened the door to the flat, Emmy saw that Julia had fallen asleep at the kitchen table. Colored pencils lay strewn about. She peered over her little sister to see how Julia had occupied the hour Emmy had been gone. Instead of bouquets, the brides Emmy had left in Julia's care now held enormous red polka-dot umbrellas. Chapter 5. After securing the blackout curtains and then gently shaking Julia awake, Emmy made toast for them and shared her news. Julia seemed happy, but was clearly unsure what Emmy's new job meant for her. Emmy saw the uncertainty in her eyes. Emmy had always known that the age spread between them meant that she would be out on her own long before Julia would. It likely hadn't occurred to Julia until she was sitting there, licking marmalade off her fingers, that Emmy had plans for the sketches that had very little to do with her. But Julia could see it now. She and Emmy were to be parted, and it was the brides that would take Emmy from her. Emmy didn't treasure for a moment the thought of leaving Julia when the time came. The sisters washed and dried the dishes in silence. After Julia got ready for bed, Emmy read to her from a volume of fairy tales that was Julia's favorite, and the girls waited for Mum to come home from work. With no sign of their mother by 10 o'clock, Emmy tucked Julia into bed. She held the drawings Emmy had given her like a storybook. "Do you like their umbrellas?" Julia fanned the brides out on her blanketed lap. "I like them very much. Polka-dot umbrellas are my favorite. I want a red polka-dot umbrella with a curly black handle that looks like licorice." "That sounds splendid." Julia pointed to one of the brides. She had drawn cartoon-like features onto the blank face, including a toothy smile and curling eyelashes that extended past the bride's hairline. That particular drawing was Emmy's second attempt at anything bridal. The skirt resembled a lacy lampshade that someone had stepped on. Julia's embellishments made it look even more amateurish.
"If it rains on her wedding day, she's going to need an umbrella," Julia said.
"You're so smart to think ahead like that.
So where will I go when you're working at the bridal shop?"
This was a detail Emmy had not wanted to ponder, though it had crossed her mind several times since she'd returned to the flat. She reminded herself that Julia was her sister, not her daughter. This was Mum's complication to work out, not hers. Emmy had a pretty good idea. It would not take much persuading for Thea from the flat next door to look after Julia for the few hours Mum and she would be gone every week. Thea, a quiet, unmarried recluse who spent her days taking care of her senile mother, doting on her cat, and reading books about the sea, adored Julia. Emmy would suggest it if Mum hadn't a better idea.
"Mum will make sure you're looked after, Jules. That's what Mums are for."
Julia looked at Emmy, an unspoken question in her eyes. Emmy didn't want to know what that question was, so she did not ask.
"Why aren't you coming to bed?"
Julia asked a moment later. "I want to wait up for Mum and tell her about my new job."
"But why do you need a job, Emmy? You're not a mum. Only mums need jobs."
Emmy took the drawings Julia held in her hands and set them on the little table in between the beds.
"Mrs. Crofton is going to teach me how to sew, Jules, and she knows somebody who might be able to help me take my drawings and make real dresses out of them. Real dresses. That's why. Say your prayers now."
Emmy rose from the bed and turned out the light. Darkness swallowed the room.
"Don't close the door all the way," she said.
"I won't."
"Sweet dreams."
Emmy settled onto the sofa with a magazine and waited for Mum, but she fell asleep. Hours later, in the gray light of dawn, the lock turned and she startled awake. Emmy sat up quickly, and Mum, equally startled, half fell against the doorframe.
"Good Lord, Emmy,"
Mum said as she caught herself.
"You scared me. What are you doing there on the sofa like that?"
Emmy smelled pipe tobacco on her, even from 10 feet away.
"Where have you been?"
Emmy said, knowing how ridiculous it sounded that she was asking that question instead of the other way around, as she had heard other mothers do. Mum pushed the door shut and smoothed a curl that had worked free of her white maid's cap. It got late last night, and it was too dark to walk home. It wouldn't have been safe. Mum strode into the room, and then into the kitchen, clicking on the light above the table. She set her handbag down and pulled the hairpins from her cap. Emmy joined her. In addition to the stale aroma of tobacco, she now smelled men's cologne. Not Neville's. Wherever she'd spent the night, it wasn't with Julia's father, whom they hadn't seen in months. Emmy was both relieved and disgusted. She didn't like Neville, but at least she knew who he was. "So you had to spend the night at Mrs. Billingsley's?" Emmy said, only minimally masking her sarcasm. Her mother tossed her cap onto the table. "I told you. It was too dark to walk home." Mum turned to the sink, grabbed the tea kettle, and began to fill it with water. That was her standard practice when she didn't want to be bothered by anyone or anything. She would turn her back on whatever the nuisance was and make tea. Emmy crossed her arms in front of her chest. "So Mrs. Billingsley's taking up smoking, then? And wearing men's cologne? Must drive you all batty." Mum switched off the tap and just stood with her back to her daughter, holding the kettle by its handle. A few seconds later, she plunked the kettle down on top of the stove. She switched on the burner and then turned to Emmy. "Let's get one thing straight. I don't report to you. You're not in charge here. I am." "So you don't deny it? You weren't at Mrs. Billingsley's last night?" The volume of Emmy's voice doubled, but she didn't care if she woke Julia. "I don't have to explain anything to you." Mum swung around to the cupboard to gather the tin of tea in a cup. Emmy saw her slender build under her maid's uniform, the fullness of her bosom, the shapeliness of her legs and thighs, and the graceful curve of her neck. Emmy saw how pretty Mum was, but how broken. She was only 31, with not a wrinkle or blemish, or so much as a strand of gray hair. Emmy didn't know what her mum had wanted to be at this stage of her life, but it came to her with crashing clarity that surely she hadn't dreamed of becoming a rich woman's kitchen maid. Emmy was never more aware of how much her very existence had marooned Mum to this scrabbling life than at that moment. Though it wasn't the first time she had contemplated how her birth changed the trajectory of Mum's life. On truly terrible days, like when Neville left for good, or when her mother ran into someone she knew who lived a carefree life of normalcy, Mum would stare at Emmy, and she would feel the weight of those lost years. Nana had told Emmy when she was 10 that it was not her fault she had been born. It was Mum who, at 16, let herself get carried away by smooth talk. That was as much as Emmy knew about the man who had fathered her. He was a smooth talker. Nana had known more than that, Emmy believed, although she had acted as if she didn't. Emmy's birth certificate read that her father was unknown. "How can you not know who my father is?" Emmy had asked Mum once, when she was old enough to know how babies were made, but too naive to figure out unknown could also mean unnamed. Mum had said Emmy was to think of herself as someone who only had one parent, just a mum. There was no one else. In more recent years, Mum had explained that there had been a party, and she'd had too much to drink. A man she barely knew told her she was pretty on a night when she felt ugly. It was as simple as that. Emmy wasn't to give that man another thought. But how could Emmy not think about the man who was her father? He had made Mum what she was, an unmarried mother and a kitchen maid, who, as near as Emmy could tell, would struggle the rest of her life to make ends meet. "Don't you ever take on blame for something you had no control over," Nana had said, and Emmy had sensed in her tone that she'd given herself the same counsel often enough. That advice came back to Emmy now as she stood there, watching Mum make tea. Then the years blended in Emmy's mind, and the last words Nana said to her
filled her head. You work in those stitches, Emmeline. It will give you something constructive to do, while your mother is out earning her keep. Those words had embarrassed Emmy when Nana said them. At 13, Emmy knew what Nana was implying. But Mum had been so angry, and the charge so appalling, Emmy had kicked the notion away. Nana and Mum had often said terrible things to each other, things that weren't true. But now it was as if a bright light had been switched on, and the blackout curtains had fallen from their rods. Mum had thrown Nana out of the house, because her mother had accused her of sleeping her way to a job in a rich woman's house. Emmy now watched as Mum poured water into a chipped Royal Doulton teacup, a cast-off from Mrs. Billingsley. She stirred in the sugar with a spoon that had also been a Billingsley hand-me-down. Emmy took in the small kitchen, with its pretty tile floors, reliable plumbing, and cabinets of hardwood. Their dining table was nothing special, but it was not a rickety tumble of sticks either. The sofa, just a few feet away from Emmy, was not moth-eaten, and the rugs were not threadbare. She and Julia had warm blankets in the winter, and comfortable beds to sleep in. Mum had her own bedroom. They always had food in the cupboards, and shoes on their feet, and clothes on their backs. Their existence was not extravagant, but they never lacked for the basics. And all this on the paycheck of an unmarried kitchenmaid, a kitchenmaid who'd landed the job with no experience. How could she have not seen it before? How could she have been so stupid to think a kitchenmaid with no husband and two children could manage to afford this flat and its modest but adequate furnishings? End of Disc 1. Someone had arranged for Mum to get the job at Mrs. Billingsley's house when Neville left. That was why Mum had been so confident the day of her interview. What kind of person would do that for a woman like her mother? Emmy suddenly understood why Nana had been so fearful when Mum came home with a uniform over her arm. Surely Mum was being compensated for something else besides boiling water for tea and shopping for hams. How could you do that? Emmy whispered to Mum's back. Mum turned around, the teacup poised for a sip and her gaze on Emmy defiant. How could I do what? How could you do that? Her mother lowered the cup. You don't know anything about anything, Em, Mum said calmly. So shut your mouth. It was almost as if she were admitting to Emmy outright that someone was paying her for sex. Emmy looked at her with revulsion. Is it Mrs. Billingsley's butler? Her chauffeur? Mum laughed, but without mirth. Really, Em? Is that what you think? Tell me I'm wrong. She lifted her cup to Emmy in a salute. You're wrong. Mum walked past her daughter, and Emmy followed her into the living room. Mum parted the blackout curtains covering the window by the front door, and a sallow sun seeped into the room. She took a long drink of her tea.
Then explain all this, Emmy yelled. Explain how you can afford this flat and the clothes in your wardrobe. Explain how you got a job as a kitchen maid when you hadn't ever been one before. Explain where you were last night.
Mum whipped around and hot tea sloshed out of the cup and onto her hand. She didn't even flinch.
How dare you talk to me that way after all I've done for you?
Her voice was even and controlled, but her eyes glistened with anger.
After all I have sacrificed for you. I never asked you to degrade yourself for any of this.
Emmy swept her arm in front of her to include the room's furnishings.
You have no business scolding me for what I do for you. And you can't keep blaming me for your mistakes.
Emmy and her mother stood there glaring at each other for several seconds. Then Mum brushed past Emmy and walked back into the kitchen. Emmy followed her. Mum poured more tea into her cup, but a second later she hurled it into the sink. The teacup shattered, and bits of porcelain flew up like ocean spray.
You can't keep blaming me for your mistakes, Emmy said again.
It was all she could say.
Mum placed her hands on the countertop and lowered her head. Her chest was heaving, but she made no sound other than the inhalation and exhalation of air in her lungs.
"I have paid for everything I have ever given you, Emmy," Mum said calmly. "I have paid and paid and paid."
The accusation slid into Emmy's core like a steel blade.
"It's not my fault you got pregnant."
Tears spilled down her cheeks.
"Just because it's not your fault doesn't mean you're not a part of this. Leave me alone, Em."
Emmy started to walk away, but then abruptly turned back. Mum was not going to ruin anything for her ever again. She was through. She would get out of the flat and out of her way as soon as she could. Emmy would prove herself worthy to Mrs. Crofton and the woman's cousin. She would move heaven and earth to make something of herself. As soon as she had her feet under her and her own place to live, she would come for Julia. Mum would be free to live whatever kind of life she wanted, or had been denied. They would both have what they wanted most.
"I got a job working for the lady at the bridal shop," Emmy said.
Mum faced her.
"What?"
"I said I got a job at the bridal shop. 2 afternoons a week and some Saturdays."
"The bridal shop?"
"Yes, the bridal shop. The owner is going to teach me to sew. She also looked at my sketches today, and she said I have talent."
"You and your brides," Mum said derisively, under her breath, but loud enough for Emmy to hear.
"She said I have talent. She likes my wedding gowns."
"Pieces of paper, Emmy. They're just pieces of paper. Just wait until you grow up, and you see what real life is like. You can draw all the dresses you want, and imagine your life an endless parade of perfect tomorrows. But wishing it won't make it happen, and neither will all the white bridal lace in the world. You're chasing after moonbeams, Em. Someday you're going to remember I told you this. You'll thank me then. Just you wait."
"I am grown up, and I'm not like you." The words fell like poison off Emmy's lips, distasteful even to her. This time, Mum flinched, but she held Emmy's gaze.
"Everybody's like me," she said.
Emmy turned from her.
"I didn't say you could take on a job," she called after Emmy, almost like an afterthought.
"I'm not asking for your permission. What am I supposed to do with Julia while you're working?" she yelled as Emmy and her mother reassumed their roles.
"I'm not a mother. You are," Emmy shouted back.
Emmy headed for the stairs that led to the bedrooms to get dressed for the day. She met Julia halfway.
"Why are you and Mum yelling?"
Julia's eyes were half closed, with a remnant of sleep. She hadn't heard much.
"Mum broke a teacup. She's just sad about it. Let's leave her alone for a little bit."
Emmy led her sister back up the stairs to their room and shut the door. Chapter 6. The first month at Primrose Bridal was magical, despite the air raid sirens going off nearly every night and the friction between Emmy and her mother. Emmy had relented and suggested Mum talk to Thea about caring for Julia when Emmy had to work, an arrangement to which their childless next-door neighbor was clearly happy to agree. Julia didn't seem to mind much, although Thea's aging mother thought Julia was a classmate from the Welsh village where she grew up, a state of affairs Julia didn't quite know what to make of. Still, the situation couldn't have been more ideal. Thea was dependable, as she hardly ever left her flat. She doted on Julia, and she refused to be paid any money. The easy fix tamed Mum's annoyance over Emmy's taking a job without having consulted her. Her attitude toward Emmy's good fortune quickly dissolved into the ambivalence Emmy was used to. After their fight that early Sunday morning, Emmy thought she began to understand why indifference suited Mum when it came to her older daughter. Surely it was because Emmy reminded Mum of herself. Emmy was nearly the age Mum had been when she became pregnant. Emmy's unfolding life mirrored hers, before she had found herself a mother at 16. Emmy wanted to think that her mother involved herself so little in Emmy's life, so that her bad luck wouldn't rub off on her. But it was perplexing to think Mum was doing something as noble as that on Emmy's behalf. Mum's way of showing love, if that was what it was mystifying. When Emmy entered the bridal shop, she could forget about what was going on at home. Mrs. Crofton was easy to work for, provided Emmy arrived on time and stayed on task. As Emmy sewed in the back room, she could hear her waiting on anxious brides-to-be, helping them choose a dress off the rack. No one wanted to wait to have a dress made, and assuring them that war or no war, they could have a beautiful wedding even with just a gown and a groom. Mrs. Crofton was also a patient instructor on the singer, an impressive machine that seemed to have a mind of its own. The needle moved so fast and was so precise. On Emmy's first Saturday afternoon, when the morning crowd died away and the afternoon shoppers had yet to appear, Emmy threaded and re-threaded the needle 50 times so that she could do it confidently with her eyes closed. And then she sewed 10 straight lines and 10 figure 8s, half an easy muslin and half an unforgiving crepe. When she was finished, Mrs. Crofton said Emmy had performed better than she had when she first learned, and that with practice, Emmy would be able to master crepe, satin, chiffon, taffeta, and all the other fabrics that floated like air, or swam like water, when a seamstress tried to guide them past a slender needle the width of a cat's whisker. On the first Saturday in June, after showing Emmy how to alter a bodice to fit a woman with far less cleavage than the dress provided for, Mrs. Crofton told Emmy she had heard back from her cousin Graham Dabney. "His father-in-law is very ill, and he's up in Edinburgh with his wife taking care of him. I don't know when he'll be back in London. Soon, he thinks. But he said if your sketches are as good as I told him they were, he'd like to meet and discuss perhaps mentoring you." Emmy wasn't sure what that meant. It sounded wonderful, but also beyond what she could afford. "Does that mean, would I need to pay him?" she asked. "Graham said if you've the raw talent, he will teach you how to make your patterns in exchange for working in his studio here in London. He designs for several theatres in the West End, and he always needs extra hands who understand formal wear. He's done this before with young designers who lack instruction and experience. Does that sound agreeable?" It sounded amazingly perfect. "1,000 times yes, Emmy said. "I didn't tell him you were not yet 16. You might want to keep that to yourself for right now. And if school starts up again, you will have to work out a schedule with him that he will be happy with, if you choose to continue with your schooling. He can be a little demanding when there's a show in production. And, of course, I will still expect you for the 10 or so hours that you work for me. Will your mother have a problem with your being gone so much?" "I make my own decisions about my time," Emmy said, and then quickly added, "My mum treats me like an adult." "You're fortunate she does, Emmeline. I doubt this would work if she didn't." Perhaps Emmy was fortunate. Up to that point, she hadn't seen the benefit of Mum's casual parenting. "One more thing," Mrs. Crofton said. "Graham has asked to see a couple of your sketches. I'd like to send him by post the 2 that I liked the best." As much as Emmy wanted to have all that Mrs. Crofton had just promised, the thought of handing over 2 of her best designs to a man she had never met made her instantly anxious. Her eyes must have betrayed her panic. "You don't have to worry about sending them to him, Emmeline," Mrs. Crofton said. "He's a designer, too. He knows how to safeguard the work of a colleague. If I were you, I might be a little afraid, too, but I wouldn't let that stop me from sending them. This is a tremendous opportunity. He wouldn't ask to see them if he wasn't intrigued by what I told him about you." For a breath of a second, Emmy considered telling Mrs. Crofton she wasn't interested in having Mr. Dabney's offer if it meant sending him 2 of the designs before she'd even met him. But Emmy had no sooner imagined herself saying these words than she realized she had been brought to a life-changing fork in the road. If she chose to keep all the brides in the box
and never trust them with anyone, it was likely they would never leave it. Mum had said wishing something didn't make it happen. Emmy had to do more than wish.
All right, Emmy said. I'll bring them on Tuesday.
It was going on early evening when Emmy got back to the flat. The air inside was stuffy and hot, even though a metal fan swung its neck from side to side, from the windowsill by the front door. Other than the hum of the fan, the flat was eerily quiet for a Saturday at near twilight. Emmy stepped into the kitchen and found Mum still in her uniform at the kitchen table, with a juice glass in her hand. In the middle of the table, a bottle of whiskey, a crumpled handkerchief, and the day's mail all touched one another in a triangle of unspoken woe. She looked up at Emmy, and her eyes, red-rimmed from earlier tears, glimmered from the numbing effect of alcohol. Pins had come loose in her hair, and one long lock curled over her shoulder in a graceful way. The light above the table tossed a mellow and compassionate light onto Mum, the bottle, the handkerchief, and the two opened envelopes.
"Expected you home earlier,"
Mum murmured with no trace of anger in her voice. It was almost as if she were jealous Emmy had the lucky fortune of having been somewhere other than the flat.
"I was learning how to use a sewing machine. What's wrong? Where's Julia?"
A band of sweat broke out on Emmy's forehead. The kitchen was sweltering. She walked over to the window above the sink and opened it to let in a breeze. But only hot, stale air met her. She turned back to face Mum.
"Why are you drinking? What happened?"
Mum downed the last bit of amber liquid in the glass and set it down gently. She fingered the corner of her mouth.
"Neville was in a car accident. He's dead."
Emmy's gaze darted to the two open letters on the table.
"How do you know? Who told you? Where's Julia?"
Mum looked up.
"His mother wrote to me."
"That's right. His mother. She's not dead after all. Neither is his father." "You were right about him, weren't you, our wise Emmeline? You tried to tell me he was a lying cheat, but I wouldn't listen." She picked up the glass, stared at its emptiness, and set it back on the table. "His last name isn't even what he told me it was. Black was his stage name." Emmy closed the distance between them.
"Mum, where is Julia?"
Mum waved Emmy's concern away with one hand and picked up the handkerchief with the other.
"Next door at Thea's. The cat had her kittens. She doesn't know."
Mum reached for the bottle and sloshed another mouthful into the glass.
"She's not going to know."
"What do you mean?"
"I mean exactly that. She's not going to know."
Mum downed the whiskey and grimaced. She wiped her mouth with a handkerchief.
"You're not to tell her, Em. I'm not going to do to her what I did to you."
"Mum!"
"I mean it, Emmy. Don't you tell her. Let her think what she wants about him. She has every right to think what she wants."
Mum reached for the bottle. Emmy leaned over her and moved it away from her outstretched hand.
"Stop it," Emmy said.
"Julia has every right to think whatever she wants." Fresh tears rimmed Mum's glassy eyes.
"Don't you tell her. I mean it, Emmy."
Emmy placed the bottle atop the fridge and used the moments when her back was turned to assess her own reaction to the news of Neville's death. She felt nothing. Neville, most of the time an unemployed actor, had lived on and off with them for 4 years, starting when Julia was 2. Emmy didn't like the way he treated Mum, and she didn't like the way he looked at her when she started to develop a woman's body. But Julia loved that Neville could sound like an old man, or a French painter, or an American cowboy. She loved his outlandish stories and crazy songs. He was the kind of father every kid thought she wanted. He never raised his voice to Julia, never corrected her, never made her mind. After he'd disappear for months on end, he'd come back with a fanciful tale of the adventure he had been on, bearing trinkets for Julia and excuses for Mum. He could see that Emmy saw straight through the lies and pretense, so he brought her nothing. He was handsome and talented. He was also an opportunist and a playboy. Emmy celebrated the day he said he was moving out for good, even though Julia and Mum both cried. They hadn't heard so much as a word from him in nearly a year. Julia believed he was somewhere in India on a movie set. His death meant nothing to Emmy.
"Did you hear what I said?"
Mum railed.
"Don't you tell her, Emmy."
Emmy turned from the fridge. Someday Julia won't be satisfied with vague answers about where he is.
Today's not that day.
Mum held out the juice glass. Emmy took the glass and placed it in the sink where the breakfast dishes were still soaking.
I never said Neville was a lying cheat.
You knew I shouldn't have trusted him. You were just a kid and somehow you knew.
God, isn't that ironic?
Emmy opened a cupboard and pulled out a tin of corned beef, a loaf of pumpernickel, and a jar of peaches, as Mum apparently had no plans for their supper.
What's done is done, Mum. Why did he tell me his parents were dead? What was the purpose of me thinking that?
Mum crumpled the handkerchief and tossed it onto the table next to the mail.
Why would he do that?
Does it really matter now? Emmy withdrew 6 slices of bread, picked off a few flakes of mold, and set them on a plate.
It matters to me. Why would he tell me his parents were dead?
Emmy could think of a number of reasons why Neville had lied to Mum about his parents. Not the least of which was that when he wanted to move in with them, it was a lot easier for Mum to welcome him when she thought he had nowhere else to go.
Because he wanted you to feel sorry for him.
Or because he liked lying to see if he could get away with it.
He was an actor, Mum. He made his living pretending to be something he wasn't.
Emmy opened the fridge and pulled out a jar of mustard.
Aunt Ju must know it all,
Mum murmured.
You asked me. I'm just answering your question. He lied to you because it suited his ends.
He told me he didn't have the money to marry me. Did I ever tell you that? What a fool I was. His father is a professor. He probably has all kinds of money. What a daft fool I was.
You'd think I'd know better.
Her voice trailed off. Emmy opened the tin, and a greasy sweet odor of canned meat permeated the air in the little kitchen.
If you don't want me to tell Julia right now, I won't. But if she asks me why he's taking so long to come back from India, or wherever else she thinks he is, I'm not going to lie to her.
Mum inhaled deeply.
You won't have to. I'll tell her my own way, on my own day. If she asks you where he is, you tell her you don't know, because you don't.
Her mother was staring at the letters on the table. It occurred to Emmy that if Neville's mother knew about Mum, she might also know Neville had a daughter.
How did his mother find you?
Emmy asked.
Does she know about Julia?
She knows, Mum said slowly, her tone calculating. He told his parents as he lay dying in a hospital in Dublin that he had a daughter in London. That's where he was. Dublin. Living with a woman half his age, no doubt.
And?
Mum swung her head around.
And what?
Emmy set the tin down.
Do they want to see her?
Mum picked up the top letter and pocketed it.
Doesn't matter if they do. What's that supposed to mean?
Just that. It doesn't matter if they do. They're not going to. I want them to want to for a good long time. I want them to want to see Julia and not be able to. I want them to want her so much it drives them near crazy. Emmy forked out a watery slice of meat and slapped it on top of one of the slices of bread. Juice spattered on the counter.
Brilliant idea, Mum. So very fair to Julia.
Mum rose on unsteady feet and yanked on Emmy's arm, forcing her to look at her.
More meat juices erupted from the tin in Emmy's hand and speckled the floor.
That's right. It is a brilliant idea. It's my brilliant idea. Julia deserves to have what is rightfully hers. Just like we all do. Just like you do, Emmeline.
Mum let go of her arm.
And I intend to see she gets it.
Emmy watched as her mother kneeled down and used the handkerchief wet from tears and whiskey to mop the meat juice off the floor.
They obviously know where you live, Mum. Do you really think you will be able to keep these people from seeing Julia until you have what you want from them?
Mum rose to her feet in one swift movement.
Is that what you think? That this is about what I want? When has anything ever been about what I want?
Emmy turned back to the sandwiches.
That's all it ever is,
she muttered. Mum pulled at Emmy's arm again, more gently this time. Her calm touch surprised Emmy.
You're wrong, Em.
Mum reached up to touch her daughter's face, and Emmy involuntarily flinched. Mum tenderly tucked a curling wisp of hair behind Emmy's ear.
Someday I am going to prove it to you.
For a moment, there was no age difference between the two of them. No crossed purposes. No opposing forces. They were just two women trying to chisel a happy life out of a giant hulk of rough-edged circumstances. Then the moment passed. Mum pulled the letter from her pocket, held it over the rubbish bin, and saw that Emmy was watching her. She shoved it back inside the pocket and sat down again.
There's a designer who wants to teach me how to make patterns for my wedding dresses,
Emmy said a moment later.
He's Mrs. Crofton's cousin. He wants to see a couple of my sketches. He might mentor me in exchange for some hours working in a studio. He designs costumes for the West End, Mum.
Mum furrowed her brow in consternation. Emmy could see that her mother was forming a response that Emmy would not want to hear.
I'm nearly 16. Practically an adult,
Emmy said, already in defense mode.
Nearly isn't is, Em. You're not an adult yet. Not in the eyes of the law.
But I know I can handle the extra work. Even when school starts in September, I can handle it. I've only a year left anyway.
Emmy's voice was rising in pitch and volume, and she tempered it to prove she was the rational adult she was claiming to be.
It's not going to be a problem, Mum.
School isn't starting in September.
What do you mean? Of course it is,
Emmy said. Mum picked up the other envelope that had come in the day's post and held it out. Emmy wiped her hands in a dish towel and then took it. The stationery was crisp and smelled of ink and importance. The return address was the school's. Emmy sensed as soon as her fingers touched the paper that the letter would change everything that had happened that day. Her eyes caught the words invasion and safety.
You and Julia are being evacuated to the countryside, Emmy,
Mum said.
They're serious about it this time. You're leaving London next week. All the children are.
Chapter 7. The first time London's children had been evacuated, nearly a year earlier, Mum had flat-out refused to send Emmy and Julia away. Her attitude then had been that there wasn't a war, not on English soil anyway, and she was not going to put her daughters on a train to God knows where. Emmy remembered her saying as much to their teachers at school, Thea next door, and anyone else who asked why Julia and Emmy were still in London. Emmy also remembered seeing something else in Mum's eyes besides the defiance. Mum had felt it wasn't in her best interest to send them off into the countryside, but for reasons Emmy was unsure of. There seemed to be more to Mum's refusal than just outward unwillingness to be parted from her daughters. There was no precedent for London being emptied of her children. No previous war had demanded it. The last time there had been an exodus for safer homes was during the plagues. And then it was only the rich who fled the cities. The adversary this go-around was not a disease, but legions of army planes carrying bombs. It was an astounding concept that Germany could strike England by air and subdue her
without even setting foot on her soil. But Mum had scoffed at the idea that the only way to ensure Emmy's and Julia's safety was to entrust them to strangers. "You and Julia aren't going anywhere," she had said when the letter had arrived in August 1939, advising her to prepare her daughters for evacuation. When the other children in the neighborhood trudged to school carrying suitcases and gas masks, their weeping mothers trailing after them, Emmy and Julia had stayed home and played checkers. Some mothers, who had looked down their noses at Mum the day before, apparently hopped over the police cordon at the train station and snatched their children back before they boarded. Those who bravely waved goodbye got postcards from billeting officials a week later, advising them of where and with whom their children were living. Emmy found out after many of her classmates started coming back to the city that foster parents arrived at designated churches and community centers in rural villages to look over the trainloads of London children, and then they chose the ones they wanted, like buyers at an auction. One of Julia's six-year-old friends had been parted from her older brother because, so the story went, he could work a field and she could not. That little girl still had nightmares 6 months later. In the end, it had all been for nothing. The doomsayers who foretold that the Luftwaffe would flatten London had been wrong. Emmy and Julia weren't the only children whose parents could not or would not bow to the notion that evacuation was the only course of action that made any sense. There was a set of parents just down the street from the Downtrees who kept their children back, and on the next block over, a couple more. The sisters and these other children had gathered at the home of one of the houses for impromptu lessons, since the schools closed after the children left the city. But within a month, the schools had all opened again because most of the children had been brought back home. At the time, everyone had concluded that Britain would win the war on the fields of France, and in the air over the English Channel. But when Dunkirk fell some months later, the air raid sirens began to wail a little more often, and the doomsayers began to raise the specter of a second evacuation of London's children. Emmy gave it little thought. Mum had kept them back during the first one. She'd do the same if there was another. Emmy had been happy to stay behind during the first evacuation, and now she was insistent that she stay behind for the second. But this time, Mum would not hear of it. For half an hour, Emmy argued with her. Emmy was too old to be evacuated. There was no real danger. How did Mum know they would be safe just because they weren't in London? And the real reason, of course. Emmy had a job. And a dress designer interested in seeing her sketches. Emmy was not going. Mum had an answer for every excuse Emmy gave her. The letter in her hand said every child 15 and younger was to be evacuated. The danger was genuine. The only safe place was in the country. As for Emmy's little job, as Mum called it, did Emmy really think there would be fittings for wedding dresses, with the war looming for real now overhead? Besides, Julia could not go alone. Not after what they had seen happen to classmates the last time. "You have to go with her," Mum said. "We're done talking about it. You're going."
"Please don't make me, Mum. It's not up to me."
"Yes, it is. You can do what you did last time. Just refuse to comply." Mum's eyes had glossed shiny with emotion.
"This time it's different. You really must go, Emmy. It is for the best."
Emmy wanted to grab her mother by the shoulders and shake her. Shake her until she told Emmy everything.
"The best for you, you mean,"
Emmy said instead. "Now you can spend the night with whomever you wish, whenever you wish, and as often as you wish." Emmy waited for the slap across her face. She wanted it. She wanted to feel the sting of Mum's reproach. She wanted the welt to rise in her skin and blossom crimson in front of Mum. Mum raised her hand slightly, and Emmy braced herself for the impact. But the slap didn't come. Mum lowered her arm, and a second later, it hung loose at her side.
"You and Julia are leaving on Wednesday," she said. "Don't tell her about Neville. She doesn't need to know right now. And this is going to be hard enough. You have to go with her, Em. Hate me if you want, but you know I can't send her away alone. You know I can't.
Mum turned and walked out of the kitchen.
Emmy felt as if she'd been slapped anyway.
Emmy dreaded telling Mrs. Crofton that she was being forced to leave London. For the next 2 days after Mum got the notice, she imagined herself arriving for work on Tuesday and telling Mrs. Crofton she was being evacuated. She pictured Mrs. Crofton replying that she would not be able to keep the job open until Emmy could return. Emmy rehearsed hearing Mrs. Crofton say that there was no way now to hide Emmy's age from her cousin, and that Emmy would have to hope she could win him over when she was older, assuming he still had any interest. Emmy pictured Mrs. Crofton muttering she should have never hired Emmy in the first place. She didn't want to keep hearing those words in her head, but they played and replayed over and over, until it seemed like she had already told Mrs. Crofton, and the dream was already dead. Everything about the situation seemed so ridiculously unfair. Emmy couldn't completely blame Mum for the turn of events, but she needed to blame someone for the war. And Emmy was angry at her mother for insisting she evacuate for Julia's sake, as though Emmy's own safety were not a consideration. Mum came home Monday evening from a meeting at the school, with a list of things the girls were to bring and not bring. Julia, excited to be going on a train to the country, like some privileged heiress, was full of questions. She was enthralled at the idea of spending the autumn at a country home and riding a horse, as if all country homes had one, and growing her own pumpkins, and skipping stones over a pond and counting stars. Emmy had only one question. How long would the evacuation last? The year before, the children began returning within a month. She could only hope it would be the same this time around. She had to get back to London. This opportunity for her and her designs would not wait for her. Wishes didn't come true by wishing. On Tuesday afternoon before work, Emmy took Julia next door to Thea's as usual. Their neighbor was in the middle of getting together a box of supplies for her Anderson shelter, a hut of corrugated steel covered in earth and half buried in the ground in her back garden. The Downtrees flat was connected to Thea's and six others, so that their brick, two-story homes looked like one long house with the same front door repeated 7 times over. Each of the narrow flats had a splash of lawn in the front and a tiny garden in the back. Brick partitions separated the gardens. The neighbors had little flower beds and tomato vines and pots of pansies in their tiny gardens. The Downtrees had a stone slab, overgrown hedges, and dirt. Thea had erected an Anderson shelter in her minuscule garden, when she was told her cat would not be welcome in the public shelter the neighbors all shared in the cellar of the shoe repair shop at the end of the street. Her private shelter nearly filled the space from garden wall to garden wall. The Andy looked like a dog kennel, made by someone who had no idea how to construct one, and so the builder decided to bury the evidence of ever having tried. Mum thought it was hideous. Julia was plain terrified of it.
Oh my goodness, do you still need me to take Julia today?
Thea's eyes were shining with agitation. The news of the second evacuation had everyone on the street preparing for the worst, whatever that was.
I still have to go to work today. It's my last day, at least for a while, Emmy said. I'm hoping we'll be back soon.
Thea stared at Emmy as though she had spoken in a foreign language. One Thea didn't understand.
Soon? She asked. Yes, I'm hoping this evacuation will be like the last one.
Thea was holding a wicker basket filled with biscuits, tins of sardines, and bottles of soda water. But she set this down and told Julia, who was standing next to her, that the mother cat had moved the kittens into a bureau drawer, and she should go see how cute they were. As soon as Julia had dashed upstairs, Thea turned to Emmy.
Has your mother not told you how things are, Emily?
Her tone made Emmy feel instantly young and uninformed, just like the child that everyone kept insisting she was.
What do you mean? France is occupied and... I know that,
Emmy interjected. It wasn't as if she never read the papers or didn't listen to the radio.
Yes, but that means now the Germans can reach us. They can fly their planes right across the channel from France. It's not like last time. They're saying the Germans plan to bomb London. They said that a year ago. Yes, but a year ago the Germans didn't have France.
Now it was Emmy's turn to stare at her as if she didn't understand the language Theo was speaking.
We're on an island, Emmy said. The Nazis can't roll in here with their tanks, like they have everywhere else. But that's why no one can say how long this will last. I would hate for you to leave here thinking you'll be back in a month. The papers say...
Emmy didn't want to hear any more. She was tired of everyone and everything deciding what was to become of everything that mattered to her. She cut Thea off in mid-sentence.
I have to go, Thea, or I'll be late. Sorry. I'll be back for Julia before 6:30.
Emmy knew she had been abysmally rude, but she simply had to get away from Thea and her box of supplies for her bomb shelter, and from the fear in her eyes. She went back to the flat for the two sketches she had promised Mrs. Crofton, and held them to her chest for a moment. These would keep her place, if not in Mrs. Crofton's shop, then in Mr. Dabney's future plans. They had to. She headed for the bridal shop, passing sandbag walls and street corners that she and everyone else had been walking past for a year and hardly noticed anymore. Everyone on the sidewalk seemed distracted by unspoken ponderings as they dashed about without a word to one another, not even a tip of the head or a weak smile. It was as though the imminent departure of 250,000 children meant London was poised to lose her innocence, and no one quite knew what to do on the eve of that loss. Emmy arrived at Primrose Bridal and opened the door. The store was empty except for one young woman buying a veil, and only a veil. Emmy surmised from the conversation the woman and Mrs. Crofton were engaged in that she was to marry on Friday morning at St. Martin in the Fields, wearing the veil and a dress of white dotted Swiss that she had worn to a piano recital in April. Her husband-to-be was shipping out with his platoon on Saturday afternoon. While Mrs. Crofton finished the transaction, Emmy went into the back room to see what hand-sewing was lined up for the afternoon, but the long table was empty. A few moments later, Mrs. Crofton joined her. She looked haggard, as if she hadn't slept well, or perhaps had eaten something for lunch that now roiled inside her.
"Are you all right, Mrs. Crofton?"
Emmy asked. She produced a wan smile. "Ask me that question when the war is over, Emmeline, and I might have an answer for you." Mrs. Crofton looked down at Emmy's hands. "You brought them?"
"Of course."
Emmy held the sketches out to her. She hesitated for a moment before taking them. "Do you have something to tell me?" The words startled Emmy, but a second later, she was glad Mrs. Crofton had suspected she was to be sent away.
"My mother is making me leave. I'm so sorry, Mrs. Crofton. I had no idea this would happen when I took this job."
The woman nodded once and cast a gaze to the sketches in Emmy's hand. "I really thought I could pretend there was nothing to worry about, as long as I just went about my business and sold wedding dresses to happy young women." Emmy hadn't rehearsed a response from Mrs. Crofton that had nothing to do with her, so she had no words at the ready. "Do you still want me to send these to my cousin?" Mrs. Crofton's voice was void of emotion and strength, as though it really didn't matter anymore that she had met Emmy, and liked her sketches, and wanted to help Emmy embark on a future as a wedding dress designer.
"I most certainly do. The evacuation doesn't change anything."
Mrs. Crofton looked up at Emmy. "Except that you won't be in London."
"But I'm going to return as soon as I can. I very much want you to send the sketches to Mr. Dabney, and I want to know when he will be returning to the city."
The woman laughed, a short little chortle shrouded in lassitude. "Oh, the confidence of the young! You would have us all drinking victory champagne by Christmas. My neighbor's son is in the British Navy, and she has told me he has no idea how long this will last. I'm not getting any more dresses from my suppliers in Paris. It will be hard to sell wedding gowns when I haven't any to sell.
And if all the London designers head to the hills, where will that leave me?
You could sell mine.
Her laugh this time was full and loud.